from
Wales, which is excellent because that's not far from England. And it's a real privilege to have you here, Aya. It's a long time since I've seen another bikini, and even seen one remotely. So it's very, very supportive to have you here, and feels special to be part of the Bikini Sangha and to have so many people joining us and hopefully enjoying that same feeling of being with the Sangha. So I think we should begin, because time goes really quickly. Even though we've got a couple of hours, it will go quickly. And I thought that we could start with a guided meditation, which I will attempt to lead. And then Ayananda Bodhi will share some Dhamma reflections with us. So, but maybe you want to say hi, Ayananda. Hiya. Whoops, sorry. I think I've muted you again by accident. Would you like?
Thank you, Aya. It's very lovely to be here and to be able to celebrate Wesak together. That's, even though the moon is beginning to wane now, but still just very lovely to be able to celebrate Wesak and be with another bikini almost very close by, and with all of the community here. It's very beautiful to see everyone.
Super. All right. And I also just want to welcome the people who are with me here at Anucampa Grove. There are like 6, 7, 8 people in the room. So it's a real beautiful mix, a lovely group of spiritual friends. So there's quite a few of us here together. Great. So now we have gathered, shall we do some meditation? Would you like to settle yourself and make yourself as comfortable as you can possibly be physically, first of all? And please, if you are not used to sitting on the floor, or even if you're not feeling in the mood to sit, find another posture that supports you at this time, whether it's in a chair, on a sofa, or even on a bed. The main, most important thing is you look after your body. Your body looks after your mind looks after your body looks after your mind. So you're working with yourself as a friend, bringing these two parts in harmony, and of course also your emotional world. So let's gently close our eyes when you're ready, and if that's comfortable for you, and just turn gently inside. Allowing the impressions of the senses to slowly fade. But keeping in mind that we are with spiritual friends. And we are coming to practice together, inspired by the life and teachings of the Buddha himself at this very special time of year. And the best way to honor the Buddha and his teachings and the sacrifices he made in sharing his teachings with us all is to internalize them, to practice them, to become the Dhamma, to see the Dhamma for ourselves. If it wasn't possible, the Buddha said, he wouldn't teach. But because it is possible and realistic to realize peace and freedom from suffering, for that reason he will teach. So just beginning by recognizing your own aspiration to practice the purity of that aspiration and the incredible good fortune you have in having a human life, a body that's still working pretty well, well enough to practice, to hear the Dhamma. To experience the Dhamma for yourself. And the opportunity to be with spiritual friends, with teachers, with companions on the path. All that is in place for each one of us right now. Just gently feeling into your body. Allowing your body to relax. Sensing yourself grounded, supported by the ground. Stable, poised and alert. And to help us come closer to our potential for awakening, I'd like you to imagine that you are sitting on the bank of a river somewhere peaceful, secluded. Perhaps under a tree. Just like the Buddha did on the night of his awakening. Somewhere you feel safe and at ease. And you realize you've come here to complete your path, to complete the goal of the spiritual life. That peace, that freedom is right there within reach, right there inside the heart. Just gently turning inwards to the peace. It's right there in this moment. When the past and the future start to fade. However subtle it first appears, just holding that peace in mind so gently, with reverence and great respect. And allow that peace to suffuse your body and mind, your breath. Deepening into this moment with every breath coming in, every breath going out. Completely one with nature. Utterly at ease. Allowing burdens to drop away, thoughts to arise and pass without disturbing the peace that's at the center of the heart, at the center of the breath. Realize this peace is a taste of nibbana. Nibbana that's peaceful and sublime. You're in the presence of the Buddha, presence of awakening, with each and every moment of peace. letting go of any last trace of effort, resistance, allowing thoughts to calm and fade away. Moving deeper and deeper into this moment, into the peace that's always there, deep inside the mind. Now gently allowing your mind to spread and notice your body, each and every part, your feet, your toes, through your legs, your knees, thighs, your hips, torso, feeling into your fingers, up your arms to your shoulders, neck and your head, and your face. Just breathing few more times with a feeling of peace, however subtle or profound. Knowing that peace is there to return to at any time. The quality of nibbana. Bring you in, inspiring each step along the path. I'll ring the bell, hopefully it will be audible for everyone here. And at the end of the third ring, you can gently open your eyes, but keeping connected to any sense of peace that may have arisen, any sense of ease or softness or well-being at all. That was one ring. I'll do it with my voice instead. Ding. That's the second ring. Dong. That's the third one. Very good. So if you're a tiny bit more peaceful, it means you've taken a few more steps towards Nirvana. Sometimes it's nice to do a short meditation just to recognize it brings results. So I'd like to invite Venerable Ananda Bodhi to say a few words now about whatever inspires her, whatever you're inspired to share. So,
thank you. Can you hear me okay?
Perfectly.
Right. Thank you, Aya. Yeah, so Vesak is probably my favorite Buddhist festival because it's remembering the Buddha, the life of the Buddha and the legacy of the Buddha, which is, of course, as Ayachanda was pointing to in the meditation, the Buddha's legacy was to remind us of our potential to awaken, you know, and there's the Buddha's life story, born in Lumbini, which was then India, now Nepal, to probably aristocrats, you know, raised in a very privileged environment with everything you could wish for, great education, wonderful opportunities for, you know, learning sports and war strategy and music and enjoying the pleasures of the senses. So very, very privileged upbringing. But actually before that, you know, he was born on his way. So it's traditional in those days for a mother to return to her own family to give birth. So his mother, Mahamaya, was on her way from where she lived back to where her mother lived, where she came from. And she gave birth to little Siddhartha on the way under a sal tree. So he was born sort of in probably a little bit stressful circumstances to some degree. And then they returned to their his father, Suddhodana. And his mother died within 7 days after he was born. So he would have experienced, even though he was just a little baby and so wouldn't have understood it yet, he would have experienced grief, the grief of his father and of his aunt who took over as an adoptive mother. So he'd have experienced some shock, some disturbance in the experience of life, even though it was before he could cognitively understand it. And then was raised in this really rather wonderful way, you know, with his aunt and cousins, and you know, there were servants, and life was very comfortable, and you know, it was a very, very privileged life. But I always think that somewhere there would have been that seed in his consciousness of knowing that there was something not quite right in this world, having lost his mother at such an early age. And he married and had a son, married Yashodhara, and they had Rahula, which Rahula is translated as fetter. So they named their child fetter, the one that holds you back. And then he had so traditionally there's the story of him seeking outside the gates of the palace, to look at what's going on outside of the kind of beautiful protected environment that he was raised in. And first of all, seeing somebody who was sick and being shocked at seeing this sick person, and asking the chariot driver who was driving him out there, you know, what's up with that person? And that person's sick, you know. And will that happen to everyone? You know, is it, what, why is it like that? And it's like, oh no, that's just normal. You know, people get sick. And then seeing somebody who is old and being shocked by this old person, because there were no old people allowed in the sort of containment of the palace to try and protect him from these realities of life. And then the chariot driver, charioteer, saying, yeah, we all get old. You know, if you live long enough, you're going to get old, and you're going to look like that. And that's what happens. And then so the Buddha realizing, oh, you know, we all get old and we all get sick. And then seeing a corpse, which in India is not unusual, actually. So seeing people carrying a corpse and learning that we all die, that everyone who's born has to go through an aging process and eventually die. So this was a big wake-up call. And whether, you know, there's some dispute about whether that was actually happened or not, but whether it did or not, I think in our own lives we might know a time when we suddenly recognize that, oh my goodness, you know, I'm going to get old too. I am old, you know, suddenly you realize, or the reality of death hits home a bit more deeply, and it sparks this yearning to understand, what is this all about? So he had this deep yearning to understand, and then went out again from the palace gates and found a mendicant, somebody with robes and who was living a spiritual life, and was curious about, well, what's going on with this person? And, oh, this is someone who's renounced the worldly life and who's seeking deep happiness within. And so then that sparks his yearning to find freedom. And so he leaves his beautiful wife and little child, and goes off and practices meditation learns meditation from this meditation master, until he's actually surpasses the skills of the meditation master. And the meditation master says, you know, I have all these followers, you know, I'll step down, you can be the leader and you can have all my followers. And the Buddha's like, the Bodhisattva Siddhartha's like, no, that's not what I'm looking for. And he finds another teacher who's further on in meditation practice, and practices until he's at an equal level, basically as high as he gets in the practice of jhanas. And this meditation master says, you know, stay with me, we'll teach together, we'll be equal, and we'll share our, you know, students. And then the Bodhisattva says, no, that's not what I'm looking for. And so he leaves this teacher and he becomes an ascetic and practices very, very severe asceticism for, I think, 5 years, 6 years, I'm not quite sure, but long, until he almost dies. And then there's the story of Sujata, the young woman who comes to the forest with this delicious milk rice to offer to one of the sacred shrines in the forest, and then sees this emaciated man who's been, you know, striving for all these years, and offers the milk rice to Siddhartha. And he takes that milk rice and eats it, and it nourishes him so that he starts to feel a sense of well-being again. And that well-being helps his mind to relax. And as he relaxes, he remembers a time when he was a boy, where he was sitting under a tree and watching his father performing a kind of ploughing ritual at the beginning of the ploughing season. And at that moment, as he was sitting under the tree, he was just in this state of absolute contentment. And his mind opened and relaxed and experienced a sense of oneness, of collectedness, of So it's probably first jhana, just like naturally falling into that state of deep peace and contentment. And he thought, maybe that's the path. So then leaving the ascetic life, much to the criticism of his colleagues who were also ascetics, and then exploring the path of awakening and being assailed by all kinds of challenges, you know, Mara coming in all these different ways to try and seduce him and discourage him or give him incredible, you know, experience incredible pain. So having to go through all of these challenges and then finally breaking through to full awakening. And it's said that he had this experience of, it was as though he was walking through an ancient forest and he found a path, an ancient path, and it led. So this was in his mind. It was, so this sort of journey was as though he was in this forest and he found an ancient path that had been forgotten, and he followed that path and it came to the ruins of an ancient city that had once been really beautiful with lakes and you know, beautiful buildings and places where you could just really enjoy a wonderful life, and it had been forgotten. And that path was the Noble Eightfold Path. And that city that had been forgotten was the city symbolic of Nibbana, of full awakening. So he wasn't finding something new, but he was rediscovering something that had been forgotten. And then he, with a little encouragement from a deity, he goes out and sees who he can share this insight with. Because it said that, first of all, he thought, oh, it's too subtle. People are caught up in craving. Nobody's going to get this, you know. Maybe I'll just meditate, you know, just enjoy the freedom that I've experienced. And then it said that the Brahma god, Sahampati, came and said, no, please, there are those with little dust in their eyes, out of compassion. Please teach the Dhamma for those who can understand it. So he went out and he found those five ascetics that he'd been practicing with. He first of all said that, first of all, he thought about the two meditation masters who had been teaching him, but they had both died just shortly before his enlightenment. And so he couldn't share with them. And then he went to these five ascetics thinking maybe they would understand. And he taught the Noble Eightfold Path. And one of those four deeply understood. So one, Kondanya, understood what the Buddha was saying and realized stream entry through his teaching. And so that was the first turning of the wheel of Dhamma. So that it began, so that the transmission and awakening began at that moment, and it's continuing to this day, which is like an amazing thing. It's still going 2,600 years later. And so then the Buddha lived and taught for, he walked around India barefoot for 45 years teaching the Dhamma. And in the beginning, he was very strategic about who he taught to. He taught to people who were already practicing, who already had different practices. So they already had good sila, good ethics. They already often were meditating. But there were certain aspects of his insight that they were missing, and that he was able to give them this little, or not so little, pointers that would just break open their understanding and awareness. So hundreds of people were becoming fully awakened in the Buddha's time, which is kind of amazing. It must have been an amazing experience, amazing time to be alive. And many of those people were already practicing before, different kinds of practices. And I think one of the key elements of the Buddha's teaching that was missing in other teachings was anatta, that the teaching of not self, or of letting go of all kinds of craving. So his insight was that craving is the source of suffering. Craving leads to suffering. When you let go of craving and identification, then there is peace. It's right here. And as soon as there's craving, wanting, desiring, trying to get away from, then we're caught in samsara. And once that's let go of, the peace is right here. So this was his teaching. And it's a very simple teaching, actually, but we are so complicated that one has to be creative. You have to be creative and find many different ways to point to this very simple truth. And so in the beginning, he was teaching, people who are already quite developed in their spiritual paths. And then as time went on, it's said that in the morning, he would wake up and he would scan the 10,000 world systems and see who is ready to hear this teaching. And then he would find someone. Sometimes it would be a deity, or sometimes it would be somebody who was coming to a teaching already, or sometimes it would be somebody just way off. There was one story of a weaver. So he's sitting there and he's scanning around. Who's ready? And he's looking in the hearts of people. And there's this weaver, simple man in his little hut weaving, and he sees, he's ready. And if he hears the Dhamma, he's going to wake up. And so, he decides to teach in this area where this man can get to, and word gets around that, the Buddha's going to teach. And so this man's trying to get to the teaching. And that morning, he's having a bad day. That morning, a cow gets out. So he's running after this cow, trying to get the cow back in. And meanwhile, the Buddha is sitting there with all of these people. People offer meal, dana, and there's a big meal. And then they ask, please, would you offer some teachings? And he says, no, not yet. And so he's waiting for this weaver to be able to come, because he knows that the weaver is ready to hear the Dhamma and will wake up. Meanwhile, the weaver's running after this cow, trying to get this thing sorted out. And finally, he manages to catch the cow, not knowing, of course, that the Buddha's waiting for him, and gets the cow in and arrives really late and expecting he's probably missed the talk, the Dhamma talk. And then he gets there and the Dhamma talk hasn't happened yet. And so then again, they ask, please, Lord, now, we've been waiting a long time, please teach us the Dhamma. And then he says, not yet. Just that man just arrived. It's that weaver. He's tired and hungry, so please give him some food, make sure he has a drink. And then he still sits there quietly. He doesn't give the teaching. So he waits till this man has been nourished and has kind of got his breath and had something to drink. And then when that man who's ready to hear the Dhamma is really present, he teaches, and this man realizes, I'm not sure what level of awakening, but has a breakthrough into one of the four levels of awakening. So this is like an amazing, beautiful thing that the Buddha would be attuned to people, to people's needs, and how they could, and would really just take care to offer this teaching, knowing that it's the most precious thing in the world. And then he taught all kinds of people, serial killers, prostitutes, kings, ministers, housewives, slaves, all kinds of people. The Dhamma was for everyone, is for everyone. And these 45 years walking barefoot through India. In northern India, it gets really cold in the winter. It gets very hot in the summer, very cold in the winter, and this human being, this man, this person, the Buddha, he wasn't a god, he was a person, offered his life to share the Dhamma for the people who were alive then and for future generations like us, that we can also hear this teaching, that we can also practice, so we can also find freedom, levels of freedom, and ultimately complete freedom. So I find it very, very inspiring that that we have this history of the Buddha, and that we can recollect. And Wesak is really about recollecting the Buddha, the Buddha's life, the fact that, you know, this person broke through to a truth that is a simple truth, but one that's hard to find, hard to see, and that he shared the teaching brilliantly, you know, in a way that has been passed on all these years, and that people have been waking up, even though we've got a bit less on the ground these days of arahants, but people have been waking up over these 2,600 years through practicing these teachings, teachings and ethics. And I, you know, there's when I used to have these pictures that were given to me by a monk in England, and they were the picture of the, it was drawn by a Japanese child, actually. They were very beautiful pictures. And so there'd be a picture of the Buddha's birth, awakening, teaching, and final passing. Those four important moments of the Buddha's life. And then I'd look at it and it's like, we're all born. All of us have been born. All of us are going to die, you know. And what are we doing in between those two times? How are we spending this life in between birth and death, whenever that may come? You know, what are we doing with this precious life? So for me, that is the importance of Wesak. It's to remember the Buddha, to be uplifted and inspired by the Buddha's teaching, and the fact that he, you know, he lived and was compassionate and wise and brilliant in his way of passing on the teachings. And that he did that not to be a great person, but to open the way for us, for everyone, for anyone and everyone, to wake up, to find our, to rediscover our true nature. So it can seem far away, you know, and you know, Ayachandra and I, we're in robes with our shaved heads, so you might think, oh, well, they're Buddhist nuns, so they're really, you know, they can do it, but I can't do it. But that's the voice of Mara. So don't believe that. The Dhamma is for everyone. The potential to awaken is for everyone. We've got to put the work in. You know, we have to see what is getting in the way, and really apply the Noble Eightfold Path. You know, explore how is that being lived in my life? Where are the weak places? Where are the things I don't understand yet on the Eightfold Path? And to see those and to explore them, because that Noble Eightfold Path is the path to awakening. It leads to awakening here and now, and it's to be cultivated, it's to be lived. And also those seven factors of awakening the Buddha points to are also very beautiful. Sati, presence, awareness, Dhamma Vijaya, being curious, investigating, so studying the Dhamma, and also being curious about what is happening here and now, having an interest in what is happening here and now, not being dull or bored, or for being curious. Piti, joy or rapture. Pasadi, calming. I think there's virya in there. I've missed a virya somewhere. Energy. And my list is getting a bit muddled now, actually. Sati, Dhamma Vijaya, virya, energy. Piti, joy. Pasadi, calming, and
it must be sukha, and then upeka. I think
upeka is the end, or is it samadhi upeka?
Is it samadhi upeka? Samadhi, yeah.
Samadhi upeka, yes. Yeah. So samadhi, collectedness, and upeka, equanimity. So those qualities, and it begins with sati. Sati is presence, awareness, and that's something we can all bring to our experience, whatever our experience is. It doesn't have to be nice. Just bringing it to how things are. And things get sweeter and clearer and more aligned with truth as we bring sati and Dhamma Vijaya, also curiosity, to our experience. So the Buddha, you know, went to great lengths to share this teaching throughout the whole of his life after awakening. And we've been amazingly fortunate in receiving that teaching, all of us. So may we make the most of it and remember that inspiring example that the Buddha gave.
Sad. Thank you so much, Aya. It's wonderful to rehear the Buddha's life from the words of a bhikkhuni and just to recollect how incredible this is that we have direct contact with the Buddha's teachings. The Buddha was teaching for us. As I said, if it wasn't possible, he wouldn't have taught. He had no incentive of his own to teach other than out of compassion. And I think that's what the teachers we have alive today do as well. So we're just incredibly blessed. And I think keeping that alive in our minds really inspires the practice. So thank you very much. We wanted to give some time now for some question and answers. And or let's say questions and responses or comments, and we may respond if we have time. So it'll be limited to one per person. So please be concise. And I think the easiest way to do it is probably in the chat. So if you do have some something to share or something to ask or reflections on what the Vaisak means for you, perhaps. Or also they can be questions about practice, any place you're struggling, you know, it doesn't have to be related directly to Vaisak. The point of Vaisak is that we deepen our practice. So please go ahead and maybe we'll share the Q&A. So we'll kind of do it between Aya and myself. And if there's something she prefers to answer, please feel free. So please go ahead. I think the easiest way is probably to send them directly to everyone in the room and then we will pick them up. Now, what I did realize is that in the schedule, we didn't really factor in a break, a cup of tea. So if you do need to have a little break and you haven't got a question to ask, it might be a good opportunity now while we wait for some of the questions to come in. And we'll do that for about half an hour or so. Okay. So who is going to be the first? The Buddha always said that those who ask questions will be intelligent in their next life. I would imagine you're already intelligent in this life, so if you ask questions, you get even more so. It's just really amazing to see.
It'd be lovely to hear from people. I don't feel you have to sort of ask something really super intelligent, yeah, actually. Yeah. Just ask whatever's relevant for you. There we are.
Hang on, you'll have to put your hand up because we want to make it fair. So there's one in the room and there's one on here. So maybe we'll
start
and you can answer, Aya, if you wish. I'm so grateful for Buddha's teachings, which continue to be so helpful for me. I'm struggling with self-discipline in regular practice. Please offer some words of inspiration. Thank you.
Yes. It's a tricky one, isn't it? Self-discipline. I recognize that myself. I think the main thing is to be motivated as to, you know, why would you want to meditate? Why do you want to meditate? Why would you want to meditate? And one thing I've found is if you just sit in the morning just a little while, I don't know what your circumstances are. I know if people have children and so on, it can be difficult, but if when you first get up and you just take a little bit of time to be still, rather than just getting up and getting into the sort of story of who you are, what you're doing, where you're going, which will then carry on through the day. If you just stop in the beginning of the day and have some stillness, it really changes things. It'll change your whole outlook on the day. And just start with a little bit of time so that you can see how it is. And that shift of experience is a motivator, really, to do that regularly, because it's very, very different to when you sit just even just for 5-10 minutes, even though I recommend longer, but even if you just do for 5 minutes, 10 minutes, first thing in the day before you get into everything, where you're just being, and maybe you're feeling the push of what you're supposed to do next, and then you just feel that and let it go. it's very, very beneficial. And it can also be helpful to listen to guided meditations. That can be helpful if you find it difficult to sit on your own. So the main motivation is through experiencing the benefits and knowing the potential.
Awesome. Thank you, Aya. So I'm going to read out the next one and maybe attempt to answer it. So I wondered what the Buddhist view is on the transgender community. So one very important aspect of the Dhamma is that the Dhamma is for all. All beings suffer. All beings are essentially sentient beings who desire happiness and recoil from pain. So whether somebody is transgender or cisgender or heterosexual or homosexual or non-binary, male, female, no matter how we identify ourselves, the path is the path for all. And I think a true Buddhist view would be one of inclusivity without exception. So for me, if a person says they have love and kindness, that should extend equally to all. and this is all very well in theory. But I think for that to really be realized and practiced, we really do need to look inside at our internal biases, and not with judgment, because we have to recognize we're all conditioned by the societies we're brought up in and the people we're around, maybe the media, the things we read. But I would say it's really important to start addressing, basically accept that you're biased, accept that we all have biases, we all have, we all have internalized bias, basically. And we need to work at coming out of that bias by talking to people who are different, getting their perspective, making friends with people we don't understand, and try and break down those barriers, try to see each other as human beings on the path together. So for me, the more inclusive a community, the more rich and enriching it is, the more we can learn about the nature of suffering, the nature of life. If you would wonder what the view is around transgender or any gender person ordaining, I would say headway is being made. And my wish would be to see a much more inclusive monastic sangha as well. So I know that this is a discussion that's happening in many monasteries, and it is slowly opening up for the ordination of gender non-binary folks, and of whom there are many, and also transgender people. In fact, there was a transgender monk years and years ago, and I forget the year, in Sri Lanka, but in the 70s or so, something like that. I think he was a novice monk, a samanera, not a fully ordained monk, but nevertheless was accepted into the monastic community at that time. So yeah, I hope that gives some thoughts on my personal view, but everybody will have their own view also. So thank you very much for that question.
There was somebody in the room. Could they ask? Because they were sort of early on, weren't they?
Yes, I have that question here for you. I thought I'll put it to you, Aya, because they can ask me anytime. So I feel at times overcome with desire that feels like need. It's
so intense.
So intense. Okay, so desire that feels like need because it's so intense. I know the antidote, but don't want to apply it. I can feel the pain of it, but I also feels pleasant in a way.
Is there a question in there? Or?
What am I going to do with it?
What is she going to do with it? Because she's still enjoying it to some extent. Although
wow.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, we can't just give up everything at once. So really, that, you know, and the Buddha isn't anti-pleasure, actually. That was one of the radical things about the Buddha in his time, you know, having done all those years of asceticism. He wasn't anti-pleasure. He was pro ethics. And he also recognized that following sensual pleasure is very limiting. So he encouraged us to notice the gratification, the danger and the escape in regard to sensual pleasure. So if your pleasure is a sensual pleasure, probably if you're in a monastery, it's pretty limited what that is. I would imagine it's quite relatively pretty ethical. But if the motivation is to experience a pleasant sensation, then noticing that you get to experience it for a while, you know, you want it, you know how to get it, you go after it, you get to experience it for a while, it's there for a bit, and then it changes, then it's gone, then you have to seek it again. So to notice that pattern. So it's not about denying pleasure, actually, but understanding the nature of sense pleasures. They're temporary. So if you explore that, it will find its own way. You know, at some point you might get tired of it, or you might find that it's helpful at the moment. You know, it helps you from it. You know, there are times when you, especially when you're living a renunciant life, a bar of chocolate now and again is very beneficial, rather than saying, oh no, I just can't do this anymore, and throwing it, you know, running out the door. Have that bar of chocolate, and you know, you get appeased for a little while, and then it gives you, you know, a stepping stone to keep going. So that's my answer.
Awesome. I'd also just like to add one thing, which is another way is to experience the pleasure of meditation, which is so much more sublime and nourishing. And then if we do have more and more familiarity with that, the sensual pleasure in comparison feels quite coarse. So it just naturally starts to feel less enticing in a sense. Right, I'll go for the next one. Thanks for the wonderful gathering. This question is about posture during sitting. I notice the body starts with upright but not uptight. But after a while, especially when body and brain are relaxed, the upper back is slowly slouching a bit, head dropping a bit. My neck is turned to one side too. If I let it be, it could send me to sleep. Oh no! It's okay. Is it okay to adjust the posture from time to time without craving to straighten the body rigidly? I've been sitting for 90 minutes every morning, so not adjusting the body posture makes the body feel tight. Thank you. It's always okay to be kind to your body. You don't have to worry about, you know, that kind of craving. Like simply craving or wishing the body to be straight is not the kind of craving that's going to lead to, you know, a bad rebirth or anything like that. So please be kind to your body. And if you find you're slouching a bit, but it's not really a problem, sometimes that's just because you're relaxed, you can leave it. And over time, you might find your body just naturally straightens almost on its own. Sometimes I've sat for hours with my posture a little bit bent, my head kind of quite low, but I've not been asleep and that's been fine as well. But if you feel it's damaging your body in some way, then absolutely adjust it. That's totally okay. So when you say you've not been and the body feels tight, then that's, I would say, your body suggesting that it might be good to adjust. So don't worry about adjusting the body. Just know why you're doing it. Know that you're doing it out of compassion, and do it with a lot of respect for your poor old body. Your body has to go the whole way. So it's important to look after your body at this stage in your life, for any stage in your life. You know, when I was younger, I used to sit for hours and hours and hours. And I do think it contributed to sciatica and other gastric issues. So please take the middle path.
Okay.
Do you want to read the next one?
Right? Yes. So after eating the milk rice, Gotama experienced deep contentment, which reminded him of his first jhana experience as a boy under the tree. Would he have not experienced this kind of first jhana contentment when mastering all the jhanas with his first two meditation teachers? What was the difference in the contentment following the milk rice that took him to full enlightenment? It's a very good question, because I always find it interesting that he did actually practice the jhanas to the highest degree, and then he left that and became an ascetic, and then, you know, that wasn't giving him the answer he was looking for. And I understand that as being, you know, when he was seeking in that way and he was practicing with those teachers, they were not fully enlightened. They had mastered the jhanas into different degrees. And there was, you know, the key insight that the Buddha understood, Buddha saw, was craving. Craving is the source of suffering. craving and identification, those two things are the source, the cause of suffering. Well, they're not two things really, they're sort of both the same thing, but different aspects of the same thing. And so when he was practicing, with a strong desire to get, understand, you know, to realize something. And he was practicing with this, you know, like you do this technique, you do this, and then you get this result. And then you do that and you get that result. And so he was doing those things and getting those results, but those results were conditioned. And so that I understand that as the inside of like, okay, I can, you know, master that all of these experiences of mind, but I don't. So the Buddha understood how to use the mind, but he didn't understand the nature of mind itself. And what he was experiencing was still conditioned. Whereas when he was remembering that experience where he was basically kind of letting go, relaxing and letting go, and then the mind naturally opened. There was no striving. There was probably no sense of self. There was just an abiding and a kind of a oneness with that direct experience, where there was no craving in that moment. So that's how I see the difference.
I find myself experiencing a lot of agitation in my meditation practice right now. Any tips, please? Thank you. Yeah. So I think underneath these sort of questions, when it's something that we tend to view quite negatively, we tend to mean, how do we get rid of it? and I don't know that that's what you mean, but I think the first step is usually making peace with the agitation, letting it be. So finding, first of all, I would say, a very wholesome relationship with the agitation, trying to get in contact with it in an embodied way and see what it needs. It maybe needs a sense of compassion or a sense of care or a sense of letting it be. And that might help to soothe it over time. But if we reach out to it with compassion so that it goes away, that tends to be a little bit too conditional. Another possibility for you could be to do some walking meditation, because sometimes the mind is a little bit too agitated to do sitting meditation. And maybe because of our lifestyle, something that's, you know, coming up for us, maybe something from the past. And if we kind of force ourselves to continue sitting, we start to develop a kind of negative relationship with meditation itself. So sometimes if you really, you know, find it's very counterproductive to sit, you might want to try doing something more active that in a sense meets that energy of agitation and gives your mind a bit more to explore. So that might be one way. And you can even start the walking meditation fairly briskly, fairly fast, until you do start to calm down. But just see that you kind of designate that period of meditation for meditation rather than start the walking and then think this isn't real meditation, I'll just give up. You know, still have your practice period, but just see if you can practice in a different posture. That's another possibility for you. The other thing is, of course, loving kindness. Getting in touch with the agitation, which may be, you know, similar to aversion or ill will. Maybe worry, and metta will help with that. Metta is a more mentally active practice. So if it's the mind that's more agitated, sometimes adding in some thinking that is still a kind of activity, but a more wholesome activity, can be helpful. And then that can displace the more disturbing thoughts. So maybe try with that. I hope that helps a little bit. Or maybe you can try and see if it does. Hey, we've got lots of questions. Next one for Aya.
So can you recommend a written description or passage or a poem that best describes the Buddha's victory over Mara and his enlightenment that inspires one to practice?
Oh.
Probably the best place to go is to the suttas, you know, to the original teachings. I must admit I can't give the references to that. Maybe Ayachanda can, I don't know.
Written description or passage or poem. I've been reading the Aryapariyasana Sutta recently, but I can't remember the whole thing off by heart, but I love that it talks about, I think it's really good, actually. I mean, it's basically the story of the Buddha's enlightenment, but it starts with his search. And I love that it starts with him saying, you know, myself being subject to old age, sickness and death, why do I search for things that are also subject to old age, sickness and death, to sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief and despair? Why don't I search for something that is not subject to those things? And I find that really inspiring. It's just such a kind of incredible insight that there could be something beyond that that's not subject to death. And that's one of the synonyms for nirvana, you know, the deathless, the end of birth, old age, sickness and death. So I would recommend that. I have it here beside me. Ariya Pariyasana Sutta. It's Majjhima Nikaya number 26. Yeah.
And Shirley is just reminding that there's a verse in the Dhammapada about the house builder.
House builder, now you've been seen. Yeah, that's really good. You will not build a house for me anymore. Your ridgepole is shattered. All the sankharas have been rooted out. Yeah. Okay, thank you for the inspiration. Oh, it's your turn, Aya.
No, it's your turn, actually.
Oh. Thank you for the inspirational talk and meditation. I have a question. I've started meditating, breath meditation, lying in the bed. When I'm struggling with insomnia and have had some amazing experiences, really uplifting. I sleep less, but feel more energized and more happy. But I'm a bit worried about replacing sleep with meditation. Could you please share some thoughts on this? Thank you very much. Well, from what you say here, your benefits far outweigh any costs. It doesn't seem that you're feeling sleepy. In fact, you say you're more energized and more happy. So I think this is wonderful. And it also seems to me that you're not forcing yourself to stay awake. It's something that's just happening naturally. When you lie there, instead of worrying about the insomnia, instead calming the mind through the breath. So I think calming the mind, you know, feeling energized and happy is resting your mind. And as long as you're lying down, you're not kind of walking around and, you know, thinking a lot, then you're also resting your body as well. So I don't think there's any problem with this at all. And you might find that when your body is really ready to sleep, you'll sleep deeply as a result. So I would say continue. You're getting good benefits from that. Yeah. Don't force yourself to stay awake.
And then Joseph, it's not actually a question, but it's more of an effusion of uplifting joy, which maybe you can all read yourselves perhaps.
Yeah.
And then I'll go to, would you like to add any verse of universal goodwill? So maybe we can do that at the end. So lovely talk and meditation. My question is regarding assisted dying and the Dharma view. It may impact my future work life. Yeah, it's a tricky one, isn't it? Assisted dying. So there's only one reference to assisted dying, which is a very unfortunate one in the suttas, where the Buddha gave teachings on asubha, like the non-beautiful practices, and then went off on retreat for a couple of weeks. And meanwhile, the monks picked it up wrongly and thought that their bodies were so disgusting that they should be killed, and were killing themselves and were telling other people that it would be very meritorious for them to the monks. So they basically were very, very confused and had wrong view. And the Buddha came back from his retreat after 2 weeks and found that the community was much diminished because many monks had taken their own life or encouraged other people to kill them. And he said, no, this is not good, and taught mindfulness of breathing as a sort of counterbalance. So, you know, the first precept is not to intentionally take the life of another living being. And so, you know, assisting somebody else to die is not within the precepts. You know, as for a monastic, it would be parajika, actually. We would be no longer considered monastics if we actively assisted somebody in taking their own life or in killing somebody. And then having said that, there are references too, I think, in the suttas, where monks who are arahants, who are fully awakened, choose to take their own life. So that is in there, and it's considered like, well, they didn't do it out of aversion, and their minds were clear, and so that is in there. So it's kind of it's not a very clear, it's not super clear. And I knew a woman, she's passed away now, but who strongly advocated for it to be legal for someone to end their own life if they were unwell. She was herself, she had cancer, terminal cancer. And she was able to, in California, help that to go through the system, that it was legal for somebody to have assisted, to be assisted to end their own life if they've sort of made a written agreement. So yeah, it's and also I know an ex-monk actually who had a terminal illness, a chronic illness that was gradually debilitating him over many years, who chose to end his own life and had a big celebration. But he was sort of planning the funeral, and he thought, oh, I want to be there. Mm-hmm. So he actually had this big celebration before he died. And then at a certain chosen date and time, his life was ended. So that's as best as I can do as an answer, actually. It's a little bit, there's many facets. Yeah. Do you have anything, Aya?
No, not really. Maybe another time. I mean, sometimes we have talked about this a little bit. I know that in Perth there's a lot of discussion about this. But it's not so much for assisted dying, it's for voluntary euthanasia. Is it the same? I'm not sure it's the same thing.
Not sure.
I think the voluntary euthanasia is usually something that most monks would say they can't encourage, but they would support another person's choice. There's a fine line there. It's not an encouragement, but the idea of choosing that voluntarily is a little bit safer than somebody assisting another. However, there's so many safeguards in the medical profession, you know, around this to make sure it is really a compassionate choice. I don't think the karma is black and white. I think there are very many shades of grey. And there was also a senior member of the Buddhist Society who chose to end their life that way. And I don't think they received any judgment on the part of any monastic. Yeah. So it's I think, something to think carefully about. I think, you know, to think of karma as black or white is tricky because it never is. So it's really about the motivation you come at it with. And, you know, I would hope that in a society like this, there's so many safeguards around this being abused that, again, it's quite a nuanced thing. So we probably only have time for one or two more. I'll try and answer the next one quite briefly. Did the Buddha ever talk about himself personally experiencing anger and how he may have gone about letting it go? Thank you. Yes, so the Buddha did talk about a time before his enlightenment. Of course, a Buddha is somebody who has uprooted greed, hate, and delusion completely from the heart. So the Buddha, after his awakening, wouldn't have experienced any anger at all. But he did say that while he was still an unenlightened bodhisattva, the word bodhisattva in the early Buddhist text means a person still seeking enlightenment, so not a fully enlightened person yet, did have thoughts of ill will, thoughts of cruelty, and thoughts of sensuality. And this is in the Dvaita Vitaka Sutta, it's Majjhima Nikaya number 19. And in there, the Buddha says he noticed those kind of thoughts, and he set them to one side. And then he noticed another kind of thought, which would be thoughts of non-cruelty, non-ill will, and letting go or renunciation. And he would put those on the other side. So basically he organized his thinking in a sense, or was able to kind of recognize the thinking as either being negative or positive. And then very objectively, rather than saying, this is terrible, this is horrendous, I shouldn't be thinking like this, he said, these thoughts of cruelty, ill will, and the sense desire lead away from nirvana. They cause suffering. They are not to be followed. Whereas the other thoughts, are beneficial and don't cause harm and don't lead away from nirvana. And even if I think them for a whole day and night, they won't cause me any harm. However, he said that eventually the mind will get tired, even with the good thoughts. And so that's when he realized he can further still the mind and collect the mind into states of samadhi. And that was the gradual process towards letting go of thinking. So yes, he did experience angry thoughts. So that's good to know, isn't it? Because, you know, as we were saying earlier, all of us can do this. There's nothing about ability or lack of ability. It just takes a lot of mindfulness and wisdom. And the wisdom that knows what, you know, the what kind of mental states are skillful and lead to suffer and lead to happiness, and what kind of mental states are unskillful and lead to suffering. So it was never a value judgment. It was always about suffering and happiness. So I hope that helps a little bit.
Do we have time for one more?
Yeah, I think we can do one more.
Okay, Johnny's question. I think this builds on an earlier question. How does someone distinguish between a craving and a need? I actually don't have a clear answer, I have to admit. And what comes to mind is the Buddha's path, you know. He went very extreme one direction and very extreme in another direction and then found the middle way. And sometimes we have to sort of do that in order to understand the difference between a craving and a need. And sometimes a need, because I think for myself, when I came into the monastic life, needs, you just know needs, you know, needs like basic needs, you know, food, shelter, medicine, you know, basics, real basics, which is what the Buddha kind of gives us. But then over time, there were certain things that actually needed attention, and it took some time to recognize that. And like Ayachanda said, you know, the body needs to be cared for, you know. So one can, the mind can push through and forcibly kind of go past various needs, and then the body kind of does have needs, you know. And the heart and mind, you know, we do have needs, and sometimes we need to take care and attend in a caring way to internal things that come up, you know, like psychological matters also, in order for them to be healed and transformed. We can't just, you know, push through. So I think we have to sort of explore and for ourselves and see. You know, and be really honest, you know, am I just like craving, you know, and sometimes the craving is to be really ascetic. Some people crave to be really perfect and ascetic, and that's too rigid, and they need to be a bit more soft and a bit kinder. Other people, you know, like, oh, you know, I really do need this ice cream. I really do need to, you know, and then it's like, well, maybe you don't, you know. So depending on your leanings to explore what's really, you know, what would happen if I didn't follow this, you know, or what would happen? So if you're a bit more ascetic, what would happen if I soften a little bit, you know, and then, or if you're rather greedy, you know, what would happen if I just let go of that thing and how does it feel? So you can use those awakening factors, actually, sati, presence, dhamma vijaya, curiosity, and virya, energy. If you use those three, then it's this energy that stays with something. So if you use those three, you start to see the results and see the repercussions. And so there needs to, you need to be give yourself the freedom to explore a little bit. Yeah.
Excellent. Well, I hope that was someone said that was most helpful. That's excellent. And yeah, really sorry that we can't come to all the questions. That's because we do want to give you an opportunity to talk together. Because most often when this opportunity is offered, people feel a little bit hesitant, but almost every time in my experience, people have come back into the main group saying how nourishing it was. So it's rare that we get to meet each other at these sort of events, and especially because so much is on Zoom, we can lack that kind of direct interpersonal relationship. So I would like to invite anyone who's up for it to join the breakout rooms for about maybe 12 minutes or so. So what we'll do is put you into groups of maybe three or four. Is that okay, Matthias? Yeah, four sounds great. And you'll get a little invitation popping up on your screen. So just accept the invitation if you're up for it. if you really feel a little bit tender and like it just doesn't feel right for you right now, that's okay. You can just hang back. Don't accept the invitation. You'll remain in the main room, and after you can have a cup of tea, you know, have a little rest. I always love this part when you see lots of lovely people with happy faces. Arriving back in the room. So wonderful. Most of you are still with us. So welcome back. And we are coming really close to the end of this session. It does really fly. Before we do that, we do want to give you the opportunity to receive, or let's say reconfirm, your precepts, five precepts. And Ayurananda Bodhi will lead that little ceremony, and you'll be doing it in English, so it's easy and you know what you're actually taking on. But before then, it'd be really lovely just to hear a few words in the chat, if you wish, to share how that was for you, and maybe anything you could share about what inspires you in your practice, or what's inspired you about the Buddha's life, whatever it might be. So it'd be lovely to hear from you in the chat, if you wish to share. Hey, really enjoyed the conversation in the breakout room. Excellent. Joyous, grateful, connected, supportive and nourishing to be in the breakout room. Excellent. Feeling connected and joyous. Oh, joy and connection. Nourishment, gratitude, the importance of community and Dhamma friends. Yeah. Lovely Kalyanamitas. Wonderful. The session has been very inspiring. It was lovely to hear about, I lost you there, about the Buddha's love, feeling content. Okay. Very nice. Says she Englishly. Yeah, I'll leave people to read Joseph's words. Oh yeah, okay. I'll just read the English part, it's not too long. Indeed, venerable, let's say. Perceiving the qualities of gratitude and appreciation of goodness in the Blessed One, I make this supreme reverence. I offer an offering of loving kindness. Inspired by two wonderful bhikkhunis and spiritual community. Brilliant. That's what we wanted. Inspiration. Inspiration is such an important energy source on this path. Thanks for a very inspiring meeting. Very grateful to everyone. Lovely to talk in person to the group that I've never talked to before. Great. Yeah, we do have some people here today, I think, who rarely come to my Zoom groups. Maybe they've come for Ayurananda Bodhi. So that's really lovely. I wonder actually who might be from the US, or maybe what part of a support group. Good to connect with others. Lovely to hear about the Buddha's life. Thank you both, venerables. Excellent. Good. So, one more and then we'll move on. So Christopher's in the USA. Brilliant. The Buddha gave me a sense of purpose and cohesive direction. So I'm very grateful for his teachings. Wonderful to see Ayurananda Bodhi. Looking forward to seeing her in Canada. Hi, you're off to Canada. Wonderful. Okay.
September.
Oh, okay. Where are you going in Canada?
I'll be at Ahimsa's monastery.
Right. Okay, great. Is it the first time you're off there?
No, it'll be the second.
Oh, good. Yeah. That must be wonderful in September. Is there like, do they get the autumn colours?
I have no idea, actually. I think it's mainly because it's a small place, and in September that you can still be outside. So it's a bit easier to navigate. Mm. But they have big mountains.
Yeah, I've seen pictures. It's just spectacular. Fantastic. All right. So now there's an opportunity to renew or to confirm or commit to the five precepts. And I'll hand over to Ayurananda Bodhi, who's our special guest, so that you have the opportunity to do that with her. And Yeah, maybe you'd like to say a few words to start something. Whatever you'd like to do.
Yeah, I mentioned, you know, when I was speaking about the Buddha laying out that path, discovering and sharing the path, that, you know, he taught the Dhamma, but he also taught the Vinaya, so the discipline and the teaching and the discipline, and that they support each other, they go together. So the discipline for at the base, sort of the bottom line, really the baseline, as the Buddha lays it out, is the five precepts. And whether you're new to these or whether they're very precious to you or somewhere in between, it's really good to at least listen to them and reflect on them and see where in your life are they being lived already and where might they be uplifted. And even if you've taken those five precepts, you know, we don't always necessarily, in fact, we use the word precept, but they're actually trainings. You know, if you translate the Pali, it's I undertake the training to refrain from killing, stealing, sexual misconduct, lying, and intoxicants. So it's about training oneself to live in a way that supports your higher potential. So, you know, if you've taken the precepts in the past, or you've tried to live by them and then you've kind of broken one or broken two and broken three, ouch, then you can start again. This is the beauty of it. You can start again. And it's not that you're, you know, thankfully in the Buddha's teaching, you're not, that we can always start again. We can start from where we are. So, we usually begin with the refuges, and I haven't done it in this format before, so it's I generally do the Pali and then the English, but this is just in the English. So I think do you usually do call and response, Ayachandra, or just everyone joins in with you?
I think maybe it's better to do call and response. Cool. I'm not really sure. I mean, most people probably know it, but yes. Maybe just homage to the blessed, noble and fully enlightened one.
Yes, and then the refuges and precepts. So, thank you. So, I wonder if Shirley, because I know Shirley's out there, whether Shirley, because it's best if people don't all have their they're best if you mute, because it becomes a cacophony. But it's nice if somebody is heard. So I was wondering whether Shirley might be willing to.
Let's see if we can.
I've known you so long. Are you there, Shirley?
Yes, hi, it's lovely to see you, Aya. I hope I can remember them, because I can remember the precepts, whether I'll sort of get it wrong. So shall I start with homage to do it in English?
No, I was going to say it.
Oh, I'll just follow you. Yes, all right.
Thank you. It's very lovely to see you too. It's been
lovely to see you, yeah.
Homage to the blessed, noble and perfectly enlightened one. Homage to the blessed, perfect and noble and perfectly enlightened one. Homage to the blessed, noble and perfectly enlightened one.
Homage to the blessed, noble and perfectly enlightened one. Homage to the blessed, noble and perfectly enlightened one. Homage to the noble, blessed, noble and perfectly enlightened one.
And so this is for everybody to join in. I've asked Shirley to be the voice so that it's not just doing it and then there's silence, but you all join in as you are able. I take refuge in the Buddha.
I take refuge in the Buddha.
I take refuge in the Dhamma.
I take refuge in the Dhamma.
I take refuge in the Sangha.
I take refuge in the Sangha.
For a second time, I take refuge in the Buddha.
For a second time, I take refuge in the Buddha.
For a second time, I take refuge in the Dhamma.
For a second time, I take refuge in the Dhamma.
For a second time, I take refuge in the Sangha.
For a second time, I take refuge in the Sangha.
For a third time, I take refuge in the Buddha.
For the third time, I take refuge in the Buddha.
For a third time, I take refuge in the Dhamma.
For the third time, I take refuge in the Dhamma.
For a third time, I take refuge in the Sangha.
For the third time, I take refuge in the Sangha.
I undertake the training precept to refrain from intentionally taking life.
I undertake the training precept to refrain from intentionally taking life.
I undertake the training precept to refrain from taking that which is not given.
I undertake the training precept to refrain from taking that which is not given.
I undertake the training precept to refrain from sexual misconduct.
I undertake the training precept to refrain from sexual misconduct.
I undertake the training precept to refrain from lying.
I undertake the training precept to refrain from lying.
I undertake the training precept to refrain from consuming intoxicants that cloud the mind.
I undertake the training precept to refrain from taking intoxicants that cloud the mind.
These are the five precepts. Sila, ethics, morality is a support. You don't have to repeat this. This is just me now. Sila, ethics, and morality is a support for true happiness, is a support for true wealth, meaningful wealth, is a support for the peacefulness that leads to liberation. So take good care of your sila, of your ethics.
Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.
Thank you so much, Shirley, for stepping in. Amazing. So we are coming to the end now. And I think before we end, Manori will say a few words and then perhaps I'll update them in a bit more detail about the events coming afterwards and also thank myself at the end. So handing over to Manori for...
Yeah, thank you both Venerable Chanda and Ayananda Bodhi for your teachings today on our online Vesak celebration event. And I'd like to say a few words about generosity. Giving goes against the stream of wanting and amazing and develops wholesome qualities that form the foundation of our Dhamma practice. The Buddha said that the wisest way to give is when one gives with a heart full of joy for the purpose of beautifying the mind, for equipping the mind, for the practice of serenity and insight, taken from Anguttara 8.33. Generosity can also be a practice of checking in deeply with us, like what would it be like to give for the benefit of all, yet without expecting anything in return. So here's at Anukampa, we offer several ways that we can cultivate this beautiful quality of giving. The first one is a one-time donation of any amount. Either here in the donation today, there's a link there. So the link will take you to online, to the website. You can do a bank transfer, PayPal, or SumUp. Or you can do a regular donation through our bank, through your bank, like on a standing orders. Or if it is not financial, you can offer your time, you can drop in, you can be an online volunteer. There may be some expertise that you have and some time that you can allocate. If you do have, then contact team@anukampa.org. We need volunteers during organizing events and so many other things. Then also you can provide meals to the monastics, either in person or if you are far away, you can do it via a cooked meal delivery or by like an online grocery. Sending groceries and other household items that the monastery may need. So there is a needed items list on the website for that. And you're always invited to join us for this kind of events, the regular events. The main events we have now are Ajahn Brahm's June events. There are talks, there is an online retreat, And there is a weekend in-person retreat as well. And there is another in-person retreat of Ajahn Brahm in November. So the details are in the website, in the Facebook page, and on the newsletter. And I wish you well in your practice, and thank you very much for your support.
Yeah, thank you so much, Manori. Manori's our treasurer on the team, and we're very blessed with a wonderful team of trustees and also advisors. Ananda Bodhi's been a very dear wise friend and advisor from, I think, pretty much the time we began. And it's just wonderful to see you here. And the other really special thing happening, actually, is that you're going to be here with us soon.
Yeah.
Barry's going to visit on the 30th of May, but late night, isn't it? Or later in the day that you arrive. So you'll be here on the 31st and 1st and 2nd?
2nd and 3rd. I think the 3rd we travel together.
Yeah, that's right. So we'll have the pleasure of your company for those 3 days. I do want to be a little bit, you know, make sure I get my time with another bikini. But of course, if anybody here would like to come and offer dana during that time, if you're able to, please, you're very welcome. Otherwise, you could offer through the online offering in some way. So, but anyway, it will just make you happy, I'm sure, to know that she's here. We also have Bhante Nito coming before that. So he's the monk also trained by Ajahn Brahm, who I was just teaching in Norway with. And he's here for a day retreat with us next week. So that's next Saturday from 2:30 till 6 p.m. He was actually staying for about a week. So again, if you'd like to come and offer dana while he's here, I mean, please, not only when the visitors are here, I also need to eat, but it might be even more inspiring when there are more people here. And then, we have a few more visiting monastics before I go to Perth. One in the first week of June, maybe the second week, I think the second week of June. And then one of the nuns from Dhammasara is coming just for the first week of July. So a lot happening here. And of course, you're always very welcome to come by and enjoy.
You have two Anagarikas now, isn't it?
I do have two Anagarikas. It's incredible. One of them's right here. Come say hi.
It'd be nice to see you.
I was thinking, you know, would Anagarika Upachala sit next to me, but her back is a little sore. And the other one is in Sri Lanka, so you're not going to see her right now, but she'll be here when you're here. She's back on the 23rd. So this is Anagarika Upachala. Oh, I think you've had some email contact with. So, yeah, it's great delight and pleasure to have a wonderful trainee and friend. That's the lovely thing about it, you know. I don't just feel it's like a job. It's a very nourishing spiritual friendship where we can both grow together. So, yeah, you'll be meeting the community that you've helped to support for quite some time. So
good, it's wonderful. It's lovely to see the community starting to fruit.
Absolutely. And I just want to turn the video around, actually, while you're also here to show you who else is in the room. Is that okay, everyone? So we have a very old Dhamma sister here. Oh, I have disconnected my mic. Hang on.
The cheese plant looks happy.
Really?
The plant. Swiss cheese plant looks happy.
That's the Dhamma sister.
Yeah. And then we have Clarissa, who's another good friend, and Nat, Erica, Casey, Gloria, and Steve. So a lovely room full of lovely people. And Gloria's travelled all the way from Hong Kong to be here for a couple of weeks. Oh, so yeah, so it's really nice. You all look to come and wave goodbye to the screen. Do you want to come over, all of you? You can wave goodbye to the group if you wish. That would be really nice to end. And thank you to everyone here for being so incredibly supportive and for your practice over all these years. We've grown together in so many ways. For those who I don't know, I hope we get to know each other a little more. So, yeah, here they all are, the lovely gang. Almost too many to fit in. But, yeah, it's definitely going here. Yes. Oh. If Matthias can take a screenshot, that would be so cool. Steve, is he there?
My
head is there. There he is. There's Steve. We need Steve's face on there. So there we go. So please take care, everybody. And thank you once again. I really look forward to seeing you soon. Thank you so much for being here with us today.
Thank you so much. Look forward to seeing you too.
So we can probably unmute you all now and we can hear your lovely voices to wave us goodbye.